My name's Dr. Sarah Metcalf, one of the editors of Australian Family Physician. And in our December issue, we have an article entitled, Is the Problem That Everything Is a Diagnosis? And I have with me today one of the authors of that article, Professor Jenny Doust, who's from the Centre for Research in Evidence-Based Practice at Bond University on the Gold Coast. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi, Sarah.
So, is the problem that everything is a diagnosis? And we, in this article, we look at the term overdiagnosis. Could we just start by explaining what we mean by overdiagnosis?
That's a very good starting point, and I think it is a place where people may object to the word sometimes. And I think that we do need to sort of work on the wording of what we're describing here.
Yes.
But really it's a term that we're using to encompass a number of things that have been happening that mean that people that may not benefit from a diagnosis are being given a diagnosis and labelled with that. And that labelling and potentially treatment may actually be more harmful than beneficial to them.
Yes, yes. And you use the example of thyroid cancer in Australia, which I thought was quite illustrative as well.
Yes, so that's one of, and this is not just in Australia, it's actually a worldwide phenomenon, and it's very closely allied to how accessible healthcare is in each country. But what has been happening is there's been a very rapid increase in the detection of thyroid cancer, but no increase in the mortality rate from thyroid cancer.
Mm.
And what that is saying is that we are now detecting a lot of insignificant thyroid cancers. And the other way that we know that this is happening is because people have done autopsy studies and found that using the current pathological definitions of thyroid cancer, that up to 33% of people have evidence of papillary thyroid cancer.
Yes.
So clearly, given that obviously not a third of the population is dying from thyroid cancer, clearly a whole lot of those cancers would never be clinically significant. And so this is the problem, that we have these ways of defining disease which are over-inclusive and including lots of people that clearly would never have had any clinical problems.
Yes, and then that leads on nicely to discussing the ways in which overdiagnosis is occurring, because obviously one of them is changes in definitions and thresholds for disease. And then we've got sort of several other areas as well where this problem's occurring.
Yes, so we think that there's probably about five different drivers of overdiagnosis. So one is this early detection of disease. So the example of thyroid cancer is partly driven because we're doing a lot more ultrasounds and CT scans, and so they're found incidentally.
Yep.
And the actual tests that we're using have become more sensitive over time.
Yes.
And then we're also doing a couple of other things that have been really partly the success part of medicine, but they are also causing some harm. So one is that we are identifying risk factors for disease, so things like blood pressure and cholesterol,
yep,
which don't actually cause any symptoms in themselves, but they're clearly risk factors for getting heart attacks and strokes and all the other kinds of cardiovascular disease. And that's been a very successful strategy to reduce cardiovascular disease because we now control people's blood pressure and control their cholesterol. But we keep lowering the threshold that we're doing that. And as we lower that threshold, then the potential for benefit gets less and the potential for harm gets more.
Mm.
And so over time, we've pushed those thresholds down to probably a point where a lot of the people that are now getting treated for things like blood pressure and cholesterol probably are getting more likely to be harmed than they are to benefit.
Yeah, so it's really almost a number needed to treat the issue when we're looking at research.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, that's a very good way to think about it, is
yeah,
that when you're at a high risk, the number needed to treat is small, and so it's very likely that you're going to get benefit. When you're at that bottom end, you need to treat a lot of people before you're going to get any benefit. And that's not just a problem of, is it cost effective, it's also a problem that it's likely to be more harmful than beneficial.
Yes, and I mean, I suppose it's a lot about interpretation of the evidence we've got, because, you know, we need to make these decisions based on, you know, what evidence is available. But I guess depending on your perspective, that might change the recommendation from any particular piece of evidence.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons that's been driving this whole area of overdiagnosis, is that most of the trials are conducted in high-risk populations. So they're often done in tertiary hospitals, patients who have high risk of an event, which is quite different to the sort of patients that you're likely to see in general practice, who are much more likely to be low risk.
Mm.
And then the other issue is that in the trials, they often exclude people who are at risk of harm. So they'll exclude people from the trials that have things like kidney disease or other sorts of comorbidities. So yeah, you're actually more likely to have harm in the general community than you are in the trials. So it is very much about how you take the results of clinical trials and then how you apply that to the general population.
Mm, yeah, very challenging. All right, and so we've sort of discussed blowing thresholds, and an example you used was hypertension. So, you know, when it was first identified as a risk factor, the numbers were much higher than they are now in terms of what was acceptable. And then we've discussed sort of labelling risk factors as diseases. So someone is sort of labelled as having high cholesterol. What about the screening sort of aspect or the early detection?
Mm. So screening is another one of these very problematic areas, because clearly there are times when screening is beneficial.
Yes.
But we've got to a point where we think that there are lots of times now where people are advocating for screening and early detection and early management, which is not backed up by evidence. And so it might be intuitively seem like a worthwhile thing to try and treat people's type 2 diabetes early, for example. But certainly so far, there's no trials, and there have been trials that have tried to show that early treatment of diabetes is beneficial, but so far they've all been negative and not shown any benefit.
That seems amazing, really, doesn't it?
It does seem amazing, doesn't it? And it's a very important message, and part of it is because a lot of us still think of diabetes as it was 20 years ago, whereas here again we've got a definition problem where they've lowered the threshold of what is included as type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
So it includes a lot more people at that milder end of disease, and it's quite likely that increased diabetic medication in that early stages is not really doing all that much to prevent the main things that patients with diabetes get. So it is, it's a very counterintuitive idea, but certainly it's, well, at least so far, there's not been any trials to say that early detection and management of type 2 diabetes is beneficial to the patient.
And certainly, you know, again, we can be doing harm with our treatments. So it really is something we have to think about.
Absolutely. And particularly with the medical treatments. So it might be worthwhile, say, if you've got someone who's in that early phase, to be, you know, really pushing lifestyle modifications and things like that, which you are what you want to be doing anyway.
Yeah.
But it's when you start using treatments with a potential for harm, such as most drugs, that you're really likely to get into problems with, you know, doing more harm than good.
Yes. And so when we touched before as well on the increased sensitivity of our testing, I mean, yes, all the time we're getting better at, you know, pathological radiological tests, but that can have its problems as well.
Yes, and one of, it's sort of a bit counterintuitive. One of the classic examples has been troponin testing, which is a much more sensitive test for MI than previous biomarkers. So that's a good thing, because we're not missing as many myocardial infarctions,
yes,
as we might have in the past. But it also means that we've changed our definition of MI, And we now have a whole lot of people that are in that sort of milder end of the spectrum, that you have to really think, you know, do we need to treat those people the same way as we treated the people with the old definition of MI?
Yes. I mean, it really creates a management dilemma, because you've got this information, but you don't really know what it means for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's
mm-hmm.
very difficult to make a good decision about what to advise.
Mm-hmm. It is. It makes things more complex. But I also think it is really about trying to think about the patient in front of you and how that evidence applies to the patient that's actually sitting in front of you.
Yes. Okay, and another area that you've discussed, you've referred to the increased medicalization of life. What are you
mm-hmm.
meaning by that?
Yes, and this is where I guess it's a very difficult issue, where people obviously are suffering and they can be having symptoms of things. So the classic one would be a child who's paying not as much attention as people would like in school.
Yes.
And then we give that child the label of ADHD. Now, that, of course, that can be a good thing. And clearly there are children who benefit from having that label and benefit from having the medications. But you have to really think through that sometimes there are harms from having that label, and it changes how people view that child and how teachers view the child, how parents view the child.
Yes.
So it really is, again, trying to make sure that if you are going to use these diagnostic labels, that you really are confident that you're doing more good than harm. And one of the things that we're actually sort of saying, given that it's quite difficult to make these decisions, is to not jump in straight away to make a diagnosis, that sometimes it's better to wait and observe. Of course, you still need to do all of the things that you need to do to support, say, a child in a classroom that's, you know, got management issues.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that you need to immediately label them with a diagnosis, which is likely to follow them around for the rest of their lives.
Yes, it's very hard to undo that once a label has been applied, but perhaps, less harm in holding off and only using it if you're very sure that it's the right thing and of benefit.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess this does apply particularly to psychiatry, this area, because, you know, you talk about unhappiness and grief being depression and that sort of thing, and I guess with psychiatry too, there's no sort of blood tests we can do, so it's all very clinical diagnosis, and I guess GPs particularly are often under time pressure, and there might be the feeling that you want to help as quickly as you can, and sometimes a label seems the best way to do that, but perhaps not always.
And I also think there's a bit of a pressure that comes from people that are experts in the field, of course, you know, quite with good intentions, are often advocating that we should be treating these diseases more aggressively,
yes.
That we should be treating them earlier in the course of the disease, that we should be trying to screen for the disease. All of these sorts of ideas of trying to push for earlier management and treatment. And GPs are the ones that have sort of really got to stand back and think, now what's really best for my patient here? And, you know, is giving them this early label and giving them early treatment the best thing, or should I try other avenues first and then only give them the diagnostic label when I'm sure that it really is going to benefit them?
Yes, yes. So what are some of the consequences for patients of these problems? We've touched on a few, but...
Yes, well, I think there's quite a few consequences that are for the patient, the labelling effects, but also the harms of medications that weren't going to benefit them. I think it's also, I mean, we really do have to think about what it's doing for the whole of medical practice and the whole of society. And I really like the quote from the GP in UK
yes.
who said that What this is too much testing of well people and not enough care for the sick. It worsens health inequalities and drains professionalism, harming both those who need treatment and those who don't. And I think most GPs would recognise this, that you spend a lot of time with people who aren't necessarily that sick, or you know, we're doing lots of checks or screening tests. We're often in people that only need them, will get only a very small marginal benefit. And often the people that really do need help are not getting it. So there's a bit of a kind of misallocation of where we're putting our energies at the moment.
Yes. And so what's the way forward for general practice acknowledging this phenomenon, Jenny? I mean, there's obviously, it's a relatively newly recognised problem and there's a lot of research to be done, but where to from here, do you think?
Well, yes, I think there is lots of research to be done in the area, and one of the things that we've recognised as you sort of go through each different topic area is how systematic it's happening across all of the different fields of medicine. So at the moment we don't actually, I think, have great ways to intervene and stop this happening. We have some things that we are hoping will happen, things like making sure that when people redefine a disease in a guideline, for example, that they actually consider what the harms of that change in the definition might be. I think at the moment our main advice would be for GPs to be very cautious about any advice to try and extend a disease definition or to call for earlier detection of a disease, and recognise that this possibly is a case of overdiagnosis and that it may not actually benefit the patients.
Yes, no, that sounds like, I mean, yes, as always, the pragmatic approach in general practice is what we do well. So
yes.
Just thinking about the person in front of you first and foremost, I think,
is
a good way to go. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much, Jenny. It's a really interesting area and I think one we'll be hearing more about in the coming years.
Yes, good to talk to you.